Our study in the book of Daniel today. No doubt you know that we left off very early in chapter 11. It has chapter 11 and 12, but you see in that little folder there's only 12 spaces for tapes. And we've already had 12 lessons, but last week we've got the backside of that tape. And so you know that we'll run about 45 minutes. At least that will be recorded on tape. And we can stick that into that album, and that's the way it'll work. And it'll also fit in well with our travel plans. Remember, as we come to chapters 10, 11, and 12, and I don't really apologize for bringing those together, we saw last time that really these three chapters fit together. They fit together in a very unique way. It is really God dealing with Daniel as he gives him a final vision. Remember, a vision was not that thing that comes to you when you're asleep, but instead God spoke to Daniel and gave Daniel a tremendous picture. He explained to Daniel every world Gentile power from the time of Daniel all the way up until the time of the end. We saw last time that in chapters 10, 11, and 12, countless number of times, it uses this phrase, the latter days, the end times, the last years. And so we know that the vision that was given to Daniel in chapters 10, 11, and 12 were not going to be details that would be fulfilled in his lifetime. But Daniel would see them, and Daniel would record them, and then you and I are the beneficiaries of it. We are seeing many of those things come true. We saw in our study of chapter 10 last time what we call a topic entitled Heavenly Beings. We saw that really the message that God would give to Daniel was such an amazing one that he actually allowed Christ to come and to be seen by Daniel, chapter 10, verses 5 through 9. And then there was an interpretation of the vision given, and that is in verses 10 through 21, we find something of the struggle that takes place on the spiritual realm. Remember, the angel who was going to come and help Daniel with the understanding of it was delayed by a prince, it says, of the kingdom of Persia for 21 days. And so we know that there was a spiritual battle going on. But notice again, chapter 10, verse 14, he says, "Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days." And so he explains to Daniel, all right, Daniel, the whole reason for this is so that you will have understanding. Look, if you will, at chapter 11 and verse 1. He said, "I'm come that you might have it confirmed and that it might strengthen you." But notice it's particularly related to the Jewish people, and notice that it will not take place until many days have passed. And so we looked at the aspect of heavenly beings. As you begin in chapter 11 and verse 2, all the way through chapter 11 and verse 20, it is what I call historical evidence. We're going to take some time this morning just to look at the historical evidence that God has presented. The reason I think it is important to go ahead and study this section is because as we see the detail that God has outlined in His Word, I think it gives us confidence as we pass into verse 36 of chapter 11. These things are yet future. As you come to chapter 12, all of the events of chapter 12 are yet future. And then as we begin to look at the things around us, I believe you'll be able to see the hand of God working in a mighty way in this day and age for the latter days and for the many years until it is fulfilled. I think are those things that are happening before us every day. And so the vision that Daniel was given, some 2,500 years ago, you and I are privileged to see some of these things come to its great conclusion. Chapter 11 and verse 2, it talks of the historical evidence. Chapter 11, verse 21 through 35, it will talk about a particular man named Epiphanes. I call him Hideous Epiphanes because I'm trying to get all ages. So let's look at the historical evidence and then let's look at Hideous Epiphanes. Chapter 11 and verse 2, it reads this way, "And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up against the realm of Greece." Now remember, this statement was written by Daniel as he comes to the end of his life. We have been commenting that in Daniel chapter 1, probably as a young lad, around 13 or 14 years old, he was taken out of Jerusalem and brought into Babylon. There he lived his life. Later in his life, there would be a number of the Jewish people that would go back to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and as well the house of God. And perhaps at this time, Daniel could be pressing 90 years old. He was in captivity for 70 years. If he was 13 or 14 when he came, that would make him, let's say, 83 or 84. And we know, according to chapter 10, it was at least 3 years after Cyrus, and from some of the other dates given, we know that it would probably be at least 6 years. So at least 90 years old. And at that time, God gives to Daniel a vision. And he says, all right, Daniel, I want you to know that in terms of Persia, there are yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth one that comes, he'll be far richer. The history that is involved in chapter 11 and verse 2, it would now take over 100 years for that to develop. But I just want to show you how accurate it is. By the way, notice the Bible does not say that there are only four kings. I've told you that during the last several months, it has been my delight to go back and to study something I probably should have studied in school, and that was the history of the Medes and the Persians and of the Grecian Empire. I thought I was allergic to history when I was growing up. I found out that it was probably my frame of mind, because it is fascinating now to read it. And among the things that I've seen is that some have even been critical of the Bible because it says the Bible said there would only be four kings. Now, look at verse 2, and does it say there will only be four kings? No, it says there are three more. The fourth one will be rich, but it does not say that that's the only kings that will come in Persia, does it? The history of the Medes and Persians, it is fascinating. Because at this particular point, when Darius is there, there will be three more kings, Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, Darius. You can find each of them mentioned and given the details, the history of it, in Ezra chapter 4. But when the fourth king comes, his name is Xerxes. Xerxes comes to power, and he was known in history. Just about every history book you read will talk of his great riches. He used those great riches to try to have a show of power, and among the things that he tried to do, he said, listen, we're going to extend ourselves beyond Persia, and we're actually going to begin to make some progress onto another continent. And as he began to make progress and begin to push his kingdom over there, there was another kingdom that was just rising to power. It was Greece. They had a very ambitious ruler, a king in Greece. His name was Alexander the Great. Oh, he was young. Matter of fact, he was a teenager. But he was a powerful king. And it was the excitement of watching this king of Persia come with his great army and his great wealth that inspired Alexander the Great. This king of Persia would soon find that he could not overtake the Grecian Empire, so he would retreat back. But it's interesting that the Bible would say, literally hundreds of years before Alexander the Great was born, in verse 3, verse 2, he shall stir up against the realm of Greece. Verse 3, and a mighty king, no doubt Alexander the Great, shall stand up, shall rule with great dominion, and shall do according to his will. Within a few years, the mighty king, Alexander the Great, who was the notable horn of Daniel chapter 8, who was really the brass belly and thighs of Daniel chapter 2, who was the ram, the rough goat that came and busted down the Medes and the Persians. He was also the leopard with four wings, or four generals in Daniel chapter 7. So the Bible has pictured him a number of times in the book of Daniel. And it says this, this king will come and he'll be a mighty king. And then it says he will be broken off. He'll be broken off in the prime and the peak of his life. And remember, Alexander the Great indeed died in the peak of his life when he was in his early 30s. He died. Really a fool's death. No battle to fight. Didn't die in battle. But he was putting his army on exhibition. And as he marched, he got marsh fever, and he died. Now, Alexander the Great had two sons, Hercules and Alexander. One of them died before he himself died. The other one, a young son, was asked by his four generals, do you want the kingdom? It's yours. He said, what would I do with the kingdom? I mean, after all, how could I rule the world? He said at one time, the four generals decided, listen, if he doesn't want it, he won't get it. And so they took the kingdom, they divided it into four parts. Within several years, they would also kill his son. And it's interesting that 15 years after Alexander the Great died, his whole family was cut off. His whole family ceased to exist. Notice, if you will, verse 4 of the Bible, chapter 11. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. Shall be divided toward the four winds, toward his four generals, in other words, of heaven. not to his posterity, not to his own family, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. Do you realize the Bible actually predicted that would happen hundreds of years before Alexander the Great was even born? Again, it's just evidence that what we have here is God saying, all right, Daniel, remember, to Daniel, all these were future. These are the things that will happen. To us, we look back. But isn't it amazing that really, in verses 2 through 5, he can summarize the entire history of the Medes and the Persians and Alexander the Great. Then you come to chapter 11 and verse 5. And here it says, the king of the south shall be strong in one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. From these four kings that took over, we have two that will primarily concern Israel. Now remember, in chapter 10, verse 14, he says, Daniel, I'm giving you this so you'll understand. I'm giving this to confirm you and to strengthen you. But he says, it is how it relates to your people, to thy people. So as you come to chapter 11, verses 5 through 20, he will concentrate primarily on two of those four. One will be the king of the south. That is always referring to the king of Egypt. The kings may rise up and die and rise up and die, but the king of the south is always Egypt. Next, the king of the north. The king of the north is always Syria, no matter what king is in power. But we'll go through a dozen kings as we go from chapter 11, verse 5 to chapter 11 and verse 20. I think if you realize that he refers the king of the south, no matter who is in power, it will help you as you come to this particular passage. The first one that rises to great power is the king of the south, or Egypt. It is interesting because history confirms this very thing, even though the Bible was written several hundred years before the historical account could be written. And this king of Egypt, he sent out one of his princes, and the prince was to go really up to Persia and to measure how strong are they. Is there any chance that as the king of the south, we could become the king of the south and the north? And when he went up there, it turns out that he was driven back, but he began to make some friends in the kingdom of the north, and later he would come back joining forces with the north to fight against the south. Perhaps part of this is involved as you come to verse 6, because as the king of the north and the king of the south come into battle, they actually agreed to peace in a remarkable way. The king of the south, the king of Egypt, offered as a peace token his daughter named Bernice. Now remember, we watched the film called The Peace Child, and we saw two tribes fighting, and the only way for peace was one of the chiefs offered his son. He said, as long as my son lives, there will be peace. In other words, if we do anything against you, you can always take the life of my son. So the king of the south says, all right, here, let's guarantee peace. I really believe it was because the king of the south was worried as he looked at the army coming down from the king of the north. He says, I'll give you my daughter. And so the king of the north says, fine, I'll give my son to marry your daughter. And for a period of time, it looked like peace might be a possibility. However, the king of the south died. These boys that were now beginning to intermarry said, hey, this is our opportunity. We can be king of the north and king of the south. You see, every one of these kings were greedy. Every one of them kept saying, I'm big, but if I could be bigger. They're not much different than we are they? I'm making it, but if I could just make it a little better. And so, what happens as the fathers die, a war breaks out. It turns out that Bernice, this daughter of the king, is a central figure. Notice in verse 6, and in the end of the years, they shall join themselves together. They did, there was peace. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her arm. When her daddy died, she really was the proper ruler of the king of the south. But the trouble was she was not strong enough to carry it off because she was married to one of the sons of the king of the north. And confusion comes in. Verse 7, but out of a branch of her roots, history says her brother, shall one stand up in his estate who shall come with an army. He shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against him and shall prevail. And almost a miracle battle. The brother of Bernice, not realizing that she was supplying information to him, marches in and defeats the king of the north. Listen, the details of this are incredible. We are reading history written 300, 400 years in advance. How could it be unless it was the Bible? See, here is Daniel. And Daniel has been given this by God. He's sitting there and he said, he said, I don't know if I can believe all this stuff is going to happen. You know, for the Medes and the Persians to fall, he could hardly think beyond that. For Greece to rise up, for this mighty king to collapse, and now for the struggle between the king of the south and the king of the north to take place, he said, how can it be? Then you will notice as well, it says in verse 7 and 8, how that he will take away captives into Egypt. He will take great amounts of money. And it turns out that the historical account says this, that in one time he brought back 40,000 talents of silver. If you will use the value of silver as of Friday, that was the value of $180 million on one battle. And the Bible has written it in advance. History can only confirm that indeed these things took place. Verse 9, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, that's the king of the north, and shall return to his own land. He goes back to Egypt. Now you might think, well, it's going to be fine, but verse 10 comes along. And verse 10 says, no, it's not fine, for what will happen when the king of the south goes back, the kings of the north, the sons of these, will say, hey, there's no reason for us to be subservient to Egypt. And so they will rise up into power. As a matter of fact, verse 11 and 12, the king of the north, really a son of the former king, is enraged. He has an army. He marches against the king of the south. Now, the reason why this battle is so important, and the reason I've gone through all these details, is first of all to show the Bible predicts it. But next, do you realize that it literally says that for hundreds of years there's going to be a fight between the king of the south and the king of the north? Do you get the picture? I'm not going to go through all the details. I'm just going to pick out another character or two. But as you go from Syria down to Egypt, every time you have one of those battles, guess what land you go through? Israel. Do you see that? That's why he told it to Daniel. He says, Daniel, I'm going to tell you every Gentile power, but I'm also going to tell you how they affect the people of Israel. Every time you read in verse 5 through verse 20, the king of the south goes up, and then the king of the north comes down, and they're selfish, and they want more and more. Every time, guess who they thump on the way? Guess who they practice on? Every weapon's tried out on Israel. Every tactic is tried out on Israel. Every time they need supplies to go back and invade the other country, guess where they get them? Israel. Israel became the doormat for the king of the south and the king of the north. And the Bible said that's exactly what would happen. Now, as you continue coming down, I want you to notice verse 17. Because it's an incredible story. As you come to that verse, and really in verse 15, we're introduced to a king of the north. That would be a king of Syria. His name is Antiochus the Great. And as he comes down, he is one who said, you know, why do we always pass through Israel and beat him up? He said, I'll just annex it. He tries that. He's not real successful. But on his way down, he will set his face, verse 17, to enter into the strength of his whole kingdom, and the upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women. Interesting tactic. For as he went down, he decided, you know, I'm having trouble defeating the king of the south. It's happened and it's worked in the past. Here's what I'll do. I will give my daughter to the king of the south. Recognize it? Now remember, we see it from verse 17 and we saw it earlier in verse 6 and we say, how could he be so silly? I mean, if it didn't work in verse 6, it's not going to work in verse 17. But remember, these are hundreds of years apart. The name of that daughter that he gave just happens to be Cleopatra. Oh, you say, oh, I mean, that's really history? I thought it was just a television movie. Well, any correlation between the television movie and history is probably an accident, but nonetheless, that's who it is. She was given as a bride when she was 7 years old. His plan is this, my little girl would never turn on me. And so the king of the south says, yeah, she can marry my son. 5 years later, when she's 12 years old, they consummate the marriage. And now, once they are married, the king of the north, the king of Syria, begins to press against her. And he really feels like he's going to have something going. Egypt is so weak at this point that Egypt says, we can't carry the battle on our own. We're going to call for help. And they call for help from a place called Rome. And the Roman Empire, a brand new world power, was just beginning to spring up. As they bring in Rome, it is interesting that the Romans came, and so Antiochus the Great outfitted 300 ships. He sailed into a magnificent, he risked everything he had, and he was defeated. He was defeated so soundly that the Romans placed a tremendous tax on him. They taxed him 2,550 talents, history is very clear, plus 1,000 talents a year. That's an incredible sum of money. Now, notice what it says in verses 18. You will notice it talks of his ships. Verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land. He shall stumble and fall and not be found. The thing that's interesting, the people were so aggravated with him that they poisoned him. They said, how could you get us under such bondage? I mean, we gave all we had to outfit your army and your navy. Verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a riser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. His son comes to power. His son says the only way to do it is to tax, and when he was taxing them to pay the debt, he also taxed the people to add to his comfort. That's typical of most rulers, isn't it? And so the glorious history, the historical evidence ends there. Now, as we come to verse 21, and I want to get less and less details, but between verses 21 and verse 35, we have a tremendous picture given to us. I call it Hideous Epiphanes. There is another ruler of Syria that stands up. He is really the youngest son of Antiochus the Great. And through some scrupulous, savage dealings, he comes to power. He was magnificent in this way. Whenever he went into battle, and if he won, he would take those things that he won and he would begin to distribute them. You will find that recorded as in verse 23. He makes a league. He works deceitfully. He outsmarts people, but he's always in the business of making leagues and gaining spoils. Verse 24, he will go to the rich places and he will take it and he will spread it. History confirms that. Then, notice as well, in verses 26 and 27, he will talk of kings that will fight against him. At that particular time, there are two brothers in Egypt that join together and they are going to begin to fight against Antiochus Epiphanes. However, these two brothers are also at odds against one another, and so they really undo themselves. And Antiochus Epiphanes goes against Egypt, verse 28, and the word comes back that he's been defeated. He has just passed from Syria down to Egypt. On the way, he thumped Israel again and again and again. And so when the word gets back that Antiochus Epiphanes has been defeated, Israel begins to celebrate. Trouble is, the next day, here comes Antiochus Epiphanes marching back home, celebrating victory, and he says, what's the celebration in Israel? They say, well, we just heard that the tyrant of the king of the north has been defeated. And we're glad he just marched through here and beat us up. He said, I'm the guy that just marched through there. And needless to say, the Jews were going to have a few tough days. It's interesting because it says in verse 28, then he shall return to his land with great riches. His heart shall be against the holy covenant. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Now, on the way back home, as he's there and he's celebrating, Egypt goes back and they say to Rome, listen, we need more help. Rome said, hey, we're looking to give help. And so now Rome enters in and Rome will pass through Israel. And guess what they do on the way through Israel? They thump them again. And they come and they stand eye to eye with Epiphanes. They draw, the Roman Empire draws a circle around Epiphanes, and he says, if you step out of this circle, he says, we declare war on you. Otherwise, you can have peace and you can go back home. And Antiochus Epiphanes withdrew his army. And he went back through Israel again, and guess what he did on the way back through Israel? He took out all his frustrations on the Roman Empire. Now, the picture is this. It didn't matter who was in power. Every one of them pursued and persecuted Israel. He said, Daniel, I want you to know it's a horrible time coming. That's why Daniel fainted. That's why Daniel said, I can't believe this is going to happen. And God said, it's going to happen because they're going to reject Messiah. When they rejected Messiah, they rejected peace. Every army, no matter where they are, they will always gather and push and defeat Israel. Isn't that a tragic history? Now do you see why Daniel fainted and said, my spirit is weak within me? Daniel spent his whole life trying to see those people built up and to go back and to build Israel and to function again. And God said, here's the look of the future. Verse 31. Antiochus Epiphanes is so frustrated because of what had happened by the Romans. It says, and forces shall stand on his part. They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. shall take away the daily sacrifice, they shall place an abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt. History records this, that Antiochus Epiphanes, aggravated at what had happened to him, humiliated at what had happened, said, I've got to go back to my country with at least something. He said, here's what I'll do. I'll go back and I'll tell them that I've taken the Jews and their land and they are one religion. And so he brings a pig, he brings a swine into the temple. And he takes that swine and he slaughters that swine as a sacrifice on the altar. Needless to say, the Jews said, that's it. If you put a swine on the altar, we're not coming in. And the sacrifices to God ceased. May I suggest to you that what we have in verses 21 through 35 is a picture of the Antichrist. Remember, the Bible is clear that the Antichrist will make treaty after treaty. And every time, no matter what happens, he persecutes the Jewish people, doesn't he? It says in the Bible, in Revelation chapter 12 and 13, that in the midst of that treaty, he will make a covenant, he'll break it. He will cause the sacrifice to stop. He will do something in a place that the Jews look at as being precious and holy. He will do something that will cause him to stop the sacrifice. What a picture Antiochus Epiphanes is. But in verses 36 through 45, I think it goes beyond Antiochus Epiphanes. While every detail up to this point could be confirmed by history, as we come through verses 36 through 45, I want you to see that these things cannot be. I believe we find between verse 35 and 36 another gap. Now, those that have been with us throughout our study, you know that on several occasions we've seen that. Remember, we saw that Christ in Luke 4, as he was in the synagogue on a particular day, read a scripture. And as he read that scripture, he said this. He said, this scripture has been fulfilled in your ears this day. And remember, he stopped right in the middle, didn't he? He stopped when it talked about some of the things that he would fulfill at his first coming, but that statement continued on and described some things that will happen when Christ comes back. Zechariah 9, we saw a pause in verses 9 and 10. Daniel 7, we saw a pause in verse 7. Daniel 8, 25, we saw a pause. Daniel 9, 27. Luke 1, verses 31 and 32. Isaiah 9, 6, remember, says, unto you a child is given. And then it says this, and the government shall be upon his shoulders. When Christ came the first time, was the government of the world on his shoulders? No. He has never ruled one day from a throne on earth, but he will, won't he? The Bible is very clear, he will. So there's a pause there of literally 2,000 years. As you come to Daniel chapter 11, verse 35 to 36, I believe there's a pause there literally of 2,000 years. Now, I can tell by your eyes that you've forgotten some of the groundwork we did before, and so let's go again to Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. Because this is such an important thing if we're to identify these things, not only in chapter 11, but as well in chapter 12. Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2, it reads this way. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach the good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn. Now, notice it ends in the day of vengeance of our God. All right? Keeping that verse in mind, now go to the New Testament, Luke chapter 4. The Gospel of Luke chapter 4, verse 16. In Luke 4, 16, it says that in Nazareth he went to the synagogue as was his custom. Verse 17, he asked for the book so that he could read, and there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah, where we had just read. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written. Now, here's what he's going to read. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captive, and recovering of the sight of the blind, to set at liberty them who are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. And he closed the book and gave it unto the minister, and sat down. And the eyes of all them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began to say unto them, This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. But he stopped right in the middle of the verse, didn't he? Now, does that mean that he will not come back and perform the vengeance of God? No, it doesn't mean that at all. But it means that right then, on earth, at that time, he was fulfilling that first part, wasn't he? When he comes back, he will fulfill the next part. And so between that phrase and Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2, there is a pause of 2,000 years. All right, now, as we come to Daniel chapter 11, and we look at verse 36, from this point on, I believe it goes way beyond Antiochus Epiphanes. I think it talks about horrible Antichrist. Here is why I think that is such. Because you will notice this, that it talks of the willful king, and the willful king in verses 36 through 45 will be fighting against both the king of the south and the king of the north. This is fascinating. Right now, we are seeing that Syria and Egypt are both against Israel, aren't they? All right? Ezekiel 38 and 39 says that when the nations align, watch this, you will see Iraq and Iran go with Israel, or with Russia. Have they? They sure are. It says that you will see Libya, Ethiopia go. You'll see Germany go. You'll see Turkey go. All of them has happened. But the Bible also says that when the Antichrist comes, and it begins to bring persecution against Israel, that the king of the north and the king of the south will go back and side with Israel. Fascinating. Egypt and Syria will not be enemies through the whole tribulation against Israel. The Antichrist will arise, and when he comes to power, both the king of the north and the king of the south will fight against him. So this could not be Antiochus Epiphanes. Next. I want you to notice this, that chapter 10, verse 14 says, the latter days. He said, it is not for many days. Listen, if that was describing Antiochus Epiphanes, then what are we doing living now 2,000 years later? That couldn't be the latter days. This is later than that. So, there's another reason. Secondly, there's nothing at all in history that corresponds to it. And it talks about the wrath of God being poured out, and that, according to Revelation, will take place in the tribulation when the Antichrist will rule. Then, verse 35 and verse 40, again it talks about the end time. And so I believe that it's important for us to see that this goes way beyond the description of Antiochus Epiphanes. It talks about horrible Antichrist. Notice in verse 36, this willful king is known as one who blasphemes against God. Remember that in Revelation chapter 12 and chapter 13, the Antichrist will be known for blaspheming against God. The New Age movement says when you see our Christ, you'll forget about your Christ born 2,000 years ago. I believe that the battle right now that is raging is a spiritual battle just like occurred in Daniel 10. As Christians, sometimes we coast and we say, oh, we got plenty of time. But just as there was a spiritual battle going on for the meaning of this to be given to Daniel, I believe that spiritual battle is taking place right now. Then, notice verse 37. It says that he will exalt himself above all that has been before him. The Antichrist will come and say, worship me. Next, verses 38 and 39. It says that he has a strange God. I think it corresponds to Revelation 13, verses 14 and 15. It says this, that he will prosper for a time. Then, verses 40 through 45, it says, the king of the south shall push at him, probably because of the covenants that he's made. The king of the north will come against the beast like a whirlwind. However, the beast will enter into Palestine, will overthrow the surrounding countries. It includes Moab, Ammon, and Edom. Amazing. Listen, these things, I believe, will take place just as detailed, just as accurately as every detail of history from verse 2 through verse 35. God left out no highlights. I challenge you to go and to read history, and you'll find it's exactly as penned. That's why people say Daniel had to be historical. And we've looked a half a dozen times. It couldn't have been historical because Christ called him a prophet. It had to be prophetic. So now as we come to that part which is prophetic, We need to realize that indeed it will be exactly this way. Then notice this, verse 43. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. These are the countries that we're seeing in the news right now. Notice this, tidings out of the east, I think China, and out of the north, I think Russia, shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to sweep away many. He shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas and the glorious high mountain. He will set a headquarters up, and he chooses Jerusalem to set it in. Isn't that incredible? The Bible talks of this 2,500 years ago. However, his end shall come. Now, as you come to chapter 12 again, we want to look at the aspects of God in a marvelous way. Daniel records at this time, Michael stood up, the great prince who stands for the children of Israel. He said, there shall be a time of trouble. Daniel is weak at this point. He's fainting at this point. He says, I can't believe all this is going to happen to Israel. And then God says, listen, I want you to know what you're going to see now is even worse than you've ever imagined. And what he talks about at this point is the tribulation. Now remember, as he begins to describe the tribulation here, he said, Daniel, it was for the people of Israel. And so, Michael comes. And he says, every nation, even at the same time, at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one of them shall be found written in the book. He said, right in the middle of this great time, Daniel, I want you to know that God is still in the business of delivering people, even Israel. Listen, the power of God, the plan of God is still in effect. The great tribulation that will come is referred to in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, as the time of Jacob's trouble. He said it is so bad that he said if it would just continue on, there will not be any flesh that will be spared. Then he speaks of this in verse 3. They that be wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness shall be as stars forever. You know, today we celebrate stars, don't we? Movie stars, sports stars. We have all kinds of superstars, don't we? The Bible says there are some stars, and these stars will shine forever. And they're not the Hollywood stars. They're not the sports stars. Have you noticed something about sports stars? I mean, a guy can have a good year and bat 340, and the next year if he bats 290, what happens to him when he comes to the plate? They boo him. Several years ago, they interviewed a man by the name of Roger Maris. Anyone remember him? You know, one year he was a hero. He hit 61 home runs. For the next 3 years, that man was booed in every stadium he walked in. If you would see him this day, he's a shell of a man. If you interview him and talk to him about anything, it always comes back to this. Why would people boo me? I broke a record they said could never be broken. Why would they boo me? Because you see, the next year they wanted 62, and the next year they'd want 63, and those stars fade, don't they? I bet you can't ever remember who won the World Series 2 years ago. And it really doesn't matter. But these stars will go forever. And these are the stars who understand what God is talking about here. He says that there will be a time of trouble. He says, all right. Daniel says this, all right. How do I know when this last time is? Chapter 12, verse 4. Daniel, shut up the words. Seal the book. Even till the time of the end. He says, here's how you'll know. Many shall run to and fro. Travel, he says, will increase. Next, knowledge shall be increased. Are we there? Look around. Are we able to travel? Incredible. The travel that we can do is incredible. He said, Daniel, you'll know, you'll see travel in a marvelous way. You'll see knowledge begin to explode on every count. Do you realize how difficult it is to live in this technical, advanced society day and age? You've got to have a mini computer to run the mini computer that tells you how to run the household. And most of us have all kinds of gadgets because they'll save us time, so we have more free time, right? So how many of you have an abundance of free time because you have all these wonderful gadgets? Oh, it takes all your free time to learn how to run the gadgets to give you free time. And then those gadgets break down, and that's not free time when you're working on gadgets, is it? And he says, Daniel, here's a glimpse of it. You'll know when the end is here. You'll see technology explode. You'll see travel go rampant. Verse 5, then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood two others. I think the same two in chapter 10. One, I think, is Christ. Another is the interpreter of it. And he says in chapter 12, verse 7, it will be for a time, times, and a half. Now, do some arithmetic with me. One, that would be the time. Times, that's plural, that's two, and a half. 3.5 years, isn't it? I'm going to show you how that fits in just a minute. He said, all right, it's going to be for that period of time. And when he shall have accomplished the breaking up of the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. Then, he says, I heard, but I understood not. So he's going to ask a question. He said, all right, when shall these be? Recognize the question? Same one. Boy, I like it when people say, wait, I don't understand it. Say it again. God comes back and says, all right, Daniel, here's how you'll know. But he said, Daniel, I want you to know that this thing, that you're understanding these things, that you're seeing, he said, these things are for the end. He said, shut up the book and seal it until the time of the end. Now remember, whatever is written on this book to be sealed, it will not be opened until the time of the end. But it is so terrible that Daniel faints because of it. It is so terrible that Daniel says, I've watched the king of the south and the king of the north pass through this country time and time again. And God says, that's nothing compared to what will happen when the Antichrist comes. And Daniel says, how could anything be so terrible? Keep your finger on chapter 12. We'll be back for a closing comment there. But I want you now to go to Revelation chapter 11. I want you to see how this fits in precisely with God's Word in the book of Revelation. In Revelation chapter 11, notice in verse 3, God says, I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, 1,260 days. Now, as the tribulation begins, remember it begins in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, when the Antichrist makes a treaty with Israel. And the very time when Israel will make a treaty with the Antichrist, there will be some of the Jews, two in particular, that say, don't do it. And these two witnesses, the scribe here, they begin to say, listen, don't do it. He's not of God. And to confirm that these people are real, verse 5, as they begin to give their message, God will allow fire to come out of their mouth. He will allow them to devour their enemies. If any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. Isn't that incredible? Can you picture that on the evening news? I mean, they are going to have some tremendous videotapes. Here are these preachers, and they've always made fun of us for preaching hell, fire, and brimstone, haven't they? Literally, they'll preach fire. Verse 6, they have power to shut up heaven. All of a sudden, they're going to say, all right, if that's the way you're going to respond to God's Word, no rain. I think they'll laugh about it for a while. And after a couple of weeks, when the wheat's harvested, they're going to say, you know, we really wouldn't mind a little shower. And they'll have them. They have power, it says, to turn the waters off and to turn it on. Next, they have power to turn the waters to blood. Remember the vacation on the lake? Not so much fun when the lake is bloody. They have power to smite the earth with plagues as often as they will. And I'll tell you what, I think they're going to will it about every day. When they shall have finished their testimony, this is beautiful, not before. When God is done, how long? 1,260 days. That divides out to exactly 3.5 years. It says this, the beast shall ascend out of the bottomless pit to make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. Right in the middle of that tribulation, right in the middle of that covenant, God is going to allow them to be killed. Verse 8, their dead bodies shall lie in the street. Then, verse 9, and the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3.5 days and shall not permit their dead bodies to be put in graves. Do you realize what a wretched thing this is? Can you imagine having a corpse lying there in the street, decaying for 3.5 days, and not allowing anyone to touch it because you want to make great over it? They will hate these people so bad. Verse 10, it says this, they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them, shall make merry, and shall send gifts one to another. Happy dead witnesses, Dave. You think Christmas is, wait till you see this celebration. And they will buy gifts and give them, saying, this is in celebration of the fact that those two preachers are dead. They plagued us for 3.5 years. They shall make merry, shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. Now listen to this. After 3.5 days, the Spirit of life from God entered into them. They stood on their feet. fear fell upon them who saw them. By the way, it said all the world would see them. Live coverage via satellite communication in Jerusalem. We'll watch them. We won't. The world will watch them. Stand up. We'll be in heaven. Oh, we probably can if you want to, but I'm going to be in my honeymoon and I'll just read the report. So, can you imagine 3.5 days of lying dead in the street? I can guarantee you that if someone is killed on the street in Wichita within minutes, they'll have that body off the street, won't they? 3.5 days. They will watch. The whole world will watch as suddenly they stand on their feet. And then they will hear a voice out of heaven that will say, come up here. And they will be raptured off of the earth into heaven. Now, watch Ted Koppel will explain that one. It'll be a dandy, isn't it? The same hour are there great earthquakes. A tenth part of the city fell. The earth was slain. Men, 7,000 die right there. And it says the second woe was past. The third comes. And by the way, the third gets worse. Isn't that incredible? The conclusion to this message on Daniel chapters 11 and 12 is called lesson number 14. It has been placed on the back of tape number 1 of the Daniel series.